Slavery is back.
Welcome to a place where private business profit from a captive labour force, yet pennies are spent on medical services to a population in which the Indigenous, the poor and the mentally ill are overrepresented. Where isolation, humiliation and degradation are facts of life. Welcome to prison.
It depends who's telling the story, I suppose. The prisoners would have one view, the people who work in the prison system would have another, and I think it's up to people to decide where the truth is.
Give government propaganda and the media spin doctors the flick. And check out Doin' Time for news, views and tunes on prison issues from Guantanamo Bay to Christmas Island to prisons and detention centres everywhere. Every Monday at 4 p.m. on your community radio, 3CR.
We are still fired up and we're still talking about revolution.
Hello and welcome to the Doin' Time show. This is 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, streaming live on www.3cr.org.au. And a warning that this episode of Doin' Time contains audio images of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have died and graphic discussion of deaths in custody. I'm Marissa and I'll be with you for the next hour. On the show today, we will bring you an interview with David Medjer-Canales, Senior Lawyer at the Human Rights Law Centre. David will speak about the letter to the UN Special Rapporteur, as well as more generally the growing number of anti-protest laws and what this means for our democratic freedoms, right to protest peacefully. After that, we will hear from Brett Collins from Justice Action, who will give an update on what's happening in youth detention, particularly in New South Wales, and speak about the absence of strategic investments in technology and educational tools that are crucial for young people's rehabilitation and future prospects. But of course, we need communities, not prisons. Finally, we will bring you an interview with Bo Spearham, a Galaray, Kuma and Marawari podcaster and radio host, who will join us to talk about the frontier wars, truth-telling and Aboriginal deaths in custody. We will be having an announcement and we'll cross over to David in a moment.
Keffiyehs are Palestinian scarves and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white keffiyeh to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to keffiyehs.org.au. That's keffiyehs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Australia has a long and proud history of peaceful protests driving social change for women's right to vote, to First Nations land rights and the rights of working people through a strong tradition of trade unionism. New South Wales Police's violent arrest of Hannah Thomas and protest crackdown has been taken to United Nations. The Human Rights Law Centre has raised serious concerns about the violent arrest of Hannah Thomas and the wider erosion of protest rights in New South Wales to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Rights to Freedom of Peaceful Assembly and of Association. I am delighted to welcome David, Senior Lawyer from the Human Rights Law Centre, to discuss this very important letter to the UN. I have had the pleasure of interviewing David before, and I've also taken the liberty of reading from the excellent media release put out by the Human Rights Law Centre. Hello, David. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me again. It's such a pleasure to be here.
It's lovely to have you. Now, David, I'm wondering if you could just start off, and excuse me, I'm just recovering from bronchitis, but I'm wondering if you could just start off by speaking about what's been happening and talk to us about the background and what the implications are for the letter to the UN.
Yeah, of course. Now, we have been working with Hannah Thomas, who is a woman who was she was arrested at a protest outside of a facility that her and the group that she was protesting with claimed was making parts for airplanes that were flying, that were taking part in the campaign in the occupied Palestinian territories. Now, the manufacturing facility denies this, but in any event, they did have a right to protest. Now, because in New South Wales, there's a protest permit system, and I will use the words protest permit, even though technically that's not actually what it is, but that's actually how people know it as. Now, Hannah and her group did not put in a protest permit. Therefore, that gave the police some really quite significant powers to basically just move them on. And in moving them on, Hannah was really quite severely assaulted by a police officer to the point that she may not regain vision in one of her eyes because she was punched with such force during this protest in an attempt just to move them on. Now, the situation in New South Wales has got so bad that that we think that the United Nations actually needs to know what is happening in New South Wales, but in Australia more broadly, particularly with the anti-protest laws that have been introduced around the country in the last 21 years. There's been over 30 anti-protest laws introduced in places all over the country. And these combinations of these anti-protest laws, the way that police all over the country, it's not just in New South Wales, are emboldened to take really, really severe action against people who are protesting for peace in Palestine. These things combined have led to Hannah Thomas being so severely injured she may not regain vision in one of her eyes. And we thought that this reached a critical point where the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Peaceful Assembly, but also we made sure that the Special Raps for Human Rights Defenders and also for the Freedom of Opinion and Expression, that these Special Rapporteurs were also notified of the really severe situation that is happening in New South Wales in particular, but in Australia more broadly.
Absolutely. And the Do and Time show have done some interviews actually on Victoria Police and the designated areas as well.
Yes, a really sort of severe tool that we see police sort of relying on, particularly for Palestine protests in particular. But when it comes to these sort of white nationalist protests, the police seem to have all of these powers suddenly disappear. The way that these things are being policed is really indicative of the problem that is much broader.
What does it mean when the New South Wales Police have unchecked discretion to determine which protests receive legal protection and which do not? And what are the dangerous consequences of these powers?
So under the permit system, and again, I really want to highlight that it isn't strictly speaking a permit system. It has become a permit system. Under the sort of permit system that exists in New South Wales, you can protest without a permit if you so wish. But if you do not put in they're called notification schemes. So if you don't actually notify the police of your intention to have a protest in a public space, then you do not have the protections of basically you could be charged with obstruction offences and unlawful assembly, which is riot offences. And a riot is not a protest under the law. So just be really clear on that. So because when you put in a notification to the police that you're going to have a protest, they decide, based on criteria that is not public, and we actually don't know how they arrive at these decisions at all, so they decide whether they will give the protection of the law to these to a protest or not. We saw recently that the big march that happened across the Sydney Harbour Bridge, where the police opposed that. That doesn't mean that the protest cannot go ahead. It still can, but people are liable for obstruction offences. And in New South Wales, however, the maximum penalty for an obstruction offence is $22,000 or 2 years in jail or both. So we think that these unbelievable penalties are so high that they actually do force people to have an interaction with the police to seek their permission to protest. And the police then exercise the discretion as to whether to allow a protest to be protected from these offences or not. So the combination of this framework is what actually is pushing people to have these really kind of encounters with the police, because if you don't get that protest permit from the police effectively, they can actually just move you on. And that's what happened to Hannah Thomas, that they moved her on with such violence and such force that she's now probably going to lose vision in one of her eyes. And all because she did not ask the police for permission to protest something that she was doing lawfully and she had every right to do, except the police just didn't like it.
An absolutely barbaric practice.
Oh, horrendous. And I mean, even just on the principle of it, we should not be in a position where we have to ask the authorities for permission to protest the authorities. I mean, it's absurd, as well as being anti-democratic. But, you know, New South Wales police were emboldened by this and they react to peaceful protests with such force and violence, and we see the really dangerous consequences as we have with Hannah's case.
So the Human Rights Law Centre is calling on the UN to have the Australian government explain how the 4-1 system in New South Wales anti-protest regime is compatible with human
That's
rights
right.
obligations. Is that right?
That's right. So under international law, it is the federal government, the national government, that actually is where the buck stops as to whether they're going to be, you know, whether they're meeting our human rights obligations. And just because it's this sort of happened in New South Wales, the Australian government can't say, well, it happened in New South Wales, that's none of our concern. Ultimately, the responsibility is with the national government. The national government is the one that signed these treaties. So we're calling on the special rapporteur to seek explanations from the government as to how the systems that are in place in New South Wales and also, you know, the anti-protest laws more broadly, how they are compatible with our human rights obligations. And if they are not, then the government must be held to account for that.
And how would that happen?
Well, I mean, ultimately, really, it's a big sort of shaming exercise. You know, as we know, I'm not sort of saying that these sort of human rights frameworks are perfect, but really, I mean, Australia is due to give its report to the Human Rights Committee or the Human Rights Council in early next year to sort of explain to the world at large what it is doing to protect human rights and what we would argue is what it is failing at protecting human rights. And it basically goes in front of the whole world to account for its action or inaction. And it is throughout that process and also basically through effectively shaming our government into taking action, how these processes work. Ultimately, the government cannot be compelled to do something like this, but it is a really, really terrible look if the national government is not keeping up its obligations to protect. I mean, we're not talking about sort of kind of tinkering around the edges. The right to protest is a fundamental human right in a democracy. In fact, protest is, I would argue, the purest expression of democracy as well as voting. And if our governments are not looking after that fundamental right, then what are they actually doing?
Exactly. I mean, the New South Wales police are essentially weaponising the Form 1 permit system to shut down the right to protest, isn't it?
Well, that's right, or at least to deny the protection of the law for some protests over others. You know, people don't have to use this regime, like this sort of Form 1 protest permit system. But if they don't, they're up to $22,000 fine or 2 years in jail or both. So I would argue that most people actually are being compelled to seek police permission or at least police sort of notification because, I mean, 2 years in jail or $22,000 fine should never be the price of admission to have your say peacefully on the streets in a democracy. I mean, that's just absurd.
It is absurd, and the Do and Time show has been keeping a very close watch on these powers, and we're going to be seeing more and more people going to prison.
Well, you know, ultimately, that's what's happening. You know, these sorts of, I mean, after particularly climate protests and some Palestine protests in New South Wales, but definitely climate protests, You have countless people, including the knitting nannies, you know, these wonderful grandmas who knit for climate action, getting arrested and, you know, being hauled through the criminal legal system just because they're demanding accountability. Like, the world is sort of gone upside down, and the end result is that more people end up being violently injured like Hannah has, and more people would be put through the criminal legal system just because they're having their say in a democracy. I mean, what message does that send?
Exactly. David, thank you so much for coming onto the program. Are there any other comments that you'd like to say in conclusion?
Yeah, look, I think ultimately it is so important for all of us to safeguard our right to protest. And every time we see a parliament or a politician or the police arguing against why we should not be protesting peacefully, then we should all be really, really sceptical of something like that. Protest is how we've made Australia a better place. And protest has a place in continuing to make this place a more just place. And we should all protect that right jealously. And from police, from parliaments, from politicians.
It's very true, David, and, you know, I've really enjoyed your company, and it's been wonderful to have you on the show to explain the finer points of law, and I'm hoping to have you back soon. Thanks a lot.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Take good care. Bye-bye.
The LGBTIQA Plus Multicultural Fair Day will be held in the city of Whittlesea this year. Funded by Whittlesea City Council and auspiced by Australian LGBTIQA Plus Multicultural Multifaith Council, the fair will have a strong human rights, social justice focus as experienced through an intersectional lens. The event is held in a safe, supportive, inclusive space consisting of art and skills-based workshops by Street Art Doyle Blender Studio, African drumming, recycled fashion and sustainable gardening, information stalls, food and giveaways. The LGBTIQA Plus Multicultural Fair Day, Saturday, November 8th, 3:30 till 7:30 p.m. at the Barry Road Community Activity Centre, 36 Barry Road, Thomastown. On-site parking available, entry is free and all are welcome. Whittlesea City Council is a 3CR supporter.
And you're back with the Doin' Time show, and you just heard an interview with David Medjikanalis, senior lawyer at the Human Rights Law Centre, speaking about the draconian violation of human rights that New South Wales police have put in place in regards to anti-protest laws. The youth justice system is still failing children in detention. The Community Justice Coalition and Justice Action presented to the Youth Justice Senate inquiry and is now building on that work. I'd like to welcome Brett Collins from Justice Action to talk about what is happening with youth in detention. In particular, we will focus on the lack of technology and educational tools for young people in prison. Hello, Brett.
Yes, good afternoon, Marissa.
Welcome to the program. It's lovely to have you back.
Yes, wonderful to be here. Great, thanks for the opportunity.
Tell me what's been going on with youth in detention. What's happening?
Oh, look, quite an incredible situation, actually. We're having so much resistance to getting the same degree of services into youth justice as there is for adults. That's really quite surprising. Anyone who's looking at the maths would have to shake their head with horror. You know, we've got in Victoria leads the charge with an amazing $2.8 million per every child in detention as of last year. And the failures is amazing. 85% of people return, according to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. So this is an amazing expenditure of money and with an amazing failure. So it would be easy to resolve the issue. It really would be, with any goodwill. And I'm just surprised that the Minister Erdogan and the Commissioner Andrea Davidson they don't aren't pushed to make sure that the services are available. I mean, the services, for example, without any doubt, restorative justice, where the kids are actually young kids. We're talking about kids at the age of 12 to 18. The kids are actually able to then talk to the people who are affected by what they did, restorative justice. That reduces crime by 38%, for heaven's sake. And this is not happening in Victoria. Right? Access to education, for heaven's sake, education. Education reduces recidivism by another 35%. And access to music, for heaven's sakes. Music and art. 65% reduction for people who have access to those sorts of services, and those services can only be given to them while they're in their cells. Well, they're by themselves, and that's not given to them. It's not given. They're sitting there abandoned, and all this amazing money is being spent on the space. So we're watching really closely and pushing hard for it to, first of all, for it to be adopted in Victoria, where they've got more than enough money to spend on it, and they've got advice from experts they should do so, and then into the other states and territories.
So the Public Accounts and Estimates Committee hearing in June 2025, they revealed the increasing pressure on the system with rising custodial populations. What I find interesting, Brett, is that the government's responded by expanding infrastructure and staff instead of employing technological innovations.
Look, it's amazing. Look, really what's happening, it's clearly seen as doing jobs for the boys. Jobs for the boys is what it's all about. How can you possibly spend $2.8 million on per kid and then not supply them access to services, mainstream services, which are out there for that purpose? I mean, how could you possibly exclude them from even from their families, from their elders? We're talking about Aboriginal kids, or even kids from a whole lot of minority groups. So they're the kids who should have access to their own community and have that supported and have access to people whom they trust, peer mentors, and have access to good services and not to have this an amazing over 500 employees. 500 employees, people say, what are they doing? But employed clustering around kids and not trusted by the kids at all. People who have no relevance at all to the kids' lives and who are just being paid extraordinary amounts of money and are clearly offering nothing. If you look at the failure, at the recidivism rate, all these kids who are coming back and then going further later into prisons.
And, you know, Brett, and I say this all the time, you know, with colonisation, and you've got over-incarceration of Aboriginal youth as well.
Look, there's no question about it. I mean, it's quite clear that there's racism in the system. There's inbuilt racism and disadvantage that has accumulated over generations. There's no question at all that that's underlying the problems. I mean, you know, the $2.8 million, you think about that's two houses, you know, every year. You know, who's getting money, that money? And who's actually holding them accountable? Where's the minister, Enver Erdogan? He's also not just Minister for Youth Justice and Corrections. He's Minister for Casino, would you believe? that talks about the values involved in this whole thing. They see this as being a money-making opportunity on the back of children and of children's anguish and the tensions inside the families from which they come. It's quite clear the money has to be redirected, and the first and easiest thing to do is to ensure that every kid has access to the same things that the adults have in New South Wales and some other states and territories. When in their cells, they can do things like education. They can have access to their families and positive peer support and people whom they respect and who are respected by the community. Those services are already being paid for. So to have them excluded from them, to have them bored and looking at a television set, for heaven's sake, a television set, why can't they flip the switch and give people access then to people whom they trust and people whom they're secure, the community trusts, and to offer them positive influences instead of all the negative cross-breeding of cross-infections and things that happens inside the youth justice system.
It's really bad. And in fact, Brett, isn't there also... Didn't Justin Justice Action have a campaign and a report to the Senate inquiry?
Oh, absolutely. Look, at the Senate inquiry, we had a global figure, a man called John Dowd, AOKC. He's the International Commission of Jurists, Vice President for the World. He was with us, and we presented to the Senate inquiry, and the analysis was clear. The having access to those services which make a difference could be turned on very easily and very simply. And the adults, say for example in the ACT, when they built the ACT prison, they had from the time it was built in 2008, They had computers installed for the adults. They built, and the following year, they built a prison for the kids without access to computers themselves. They did it right from the very beginning. They regarded the kids as being maybe unworthy, or maybe, I don't know, maybe there's a sense of contempt there, that the children shouldn't have access to the same sorts of services that their adults were getting in the ACT, and they still don't have it. So, you know, we've got a job of work to do for sure to ensure that first of all, the ministers, the commissioners, and the public generally, and the media, see how unfair it is to the children and how it just is perpetuating disadvantage. It must change.
Yeah, look, the Doing Time show has done a lot of extensive work on, you know, looking at alternatives to youth detention, and in particular for First Nations kids. You know, I mean, all children need to be with their families. All children need to have innovative programs.
Look, absolutely, and it's quite provably of great benefit to have access to, for example, music. A lot of the kids who are actually in a youth justice centre, they've been expelled from school. They regard themselves as themselves, and they regard themselves as being, you know, having failed, and they think they haven't got much chance to succeed in the mainstream education system. But there are many ways in which they can be engaged in education and personal development, and one of them, easy one, is music. Music is such a beautiful thing, and people can expand on just a base of some sort where they feel that they can achieve. And it's music and art. And then people who have some deficits. There are many kids who have some disadvantage in different sorts of ways, even disabilities. Those kids can have a very fine expression in art and creation and expression and showing it to people and of course the jobs that follow, instead of sitting inside a cell and then of course in the process absorbing enormous amount of community money and also all the disadvantage that follows and of course almost 100% going on from the youth justice centres into the prisons. There was actually a very significant report, actually, by a couple of professors, a man called James Ogloff and a woman called Penny Armitage, and they actually looked at the review system there in Victoria, and they said that the system lacks strategic planning and technology investments. They said that it's absolutely essential. They said without internet access, the capacity for, and the Parkville College, which was actually quite a significant college within Parkville, the centre, that they had to needed to undertake external programs. And they said they need access to the internet, and nothing has happened. And yet this has happened.
Basically, look, you and I have been talking quite a lot on this show over the years about, you know, getting education into the youth. I mean, there are some adult prisons that have them, but it's not enough.
And then to be locked in a cell, everyone agrees, 14 hours a day locked in a cell. Come on. If you can't use that time productively, when you don't have any distractions around you, you know, when you have a chance to actually learn something and to have fun instead of sitting back passively looking at a television set, that is ridiculous and outrageous, and we should call it out for the outrage it is. It's not good enough for the minister to avoid any conversation about it, and for that matter, the opposition to have not raised it in the discussions, because this is a key issue: access to the services that will make the difference, and ensuring that the money is not wasted, and the children's lives wasted. It's an absolute tragedy. It's a crime.
It's a violation of human rights. Brett, thank you so much for coming onto the program.
Okay, thank you, Marissa.
Are there any final comments that you want to make?
I think there's no doubt at all that is increasingly an understanding having access to technology in the cells can be a really expansionary, and that allows access to all the services that previously weren't available. So, and the other thing about this is that there's a disadvantage now. At one time, people were sending letters into others inside the cells. You had letters. You had a series of programs which were printed out and handed out inside the cells, and you could take it back to your cell. Those things are no longer available. So, prisoners and youth justice have to have access to a computers in their cells so they can properly interact and get the benefits. So this, it's a campaign that will be won, but it's just too slow. It's not good enough.
It's not good enough. And anybody, jump onto the Justice Action website and have a look at all the reports.
Very good, very good. Okay. Thank you, Marissa.
Thanks a lot, Brett. You take care.
Me too. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Throughout September, we're asking you to become a regular donor. By setting up an ongoing automatic monthly donation, you'll help provide a stable foundation for 3CR. If we know we can count on your donation every month, it means we can better plan and resource our broadcasting. Whether it's First Nations justice, workers' rights, climate action, independent music, housing advocacy, or disability activism, your regular support ensures that these movements and struggles have a platform every single week. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
And you just heard an interview with Brett Collins just before that announcement from Justice Action, speaking about youth detention and the fact that they have a big lack of educational tools in prison. Aboriginal people have sacrificed their lives in the frontier wars for us to be here. And this is a quote from Bo Spearim, creator and host of a podcast called Frontier War Stories. The podcast is dedicated to truth-telling about a side of Australian history that has been left out of the history books. Each episode, he speaks with different First Nations and non-Indigenous people about research, books and oral histories that document the first 140 years of conflict and resistance after European invasion. I'd like to welcome Bo to the show to have a yarn about all this. And personally, I really love having Bo on the show because he's so knowledgeable and I really enjoy talking to him and learning about what happened in the Frontier Wars. Hi, Bo.
Hey, how you going, Marissa?
Lovely to have you. I'm just recovering from bronchitis. But we've got to keep going.
That's good.
Now, can you tell us, first of all, what land you're on?
Yep. So just real quickly, Yama, Bo Spearim, Gumarai Kuma, Marawari, born in Western Sydney, grew up on the south side of Brisbane, and my old man is from Maureen, from a mission, and my mum, she's from Brewarrina in Gadigal, from Mission and Reserve, where she spent her early days and her childhood. But yeah, on Yagara country, this is home.
So there's been quite a lot of things happening, isn't there, about truth telling and you know, the frontier wars have not really been put too much in the media, have they?
No. And, you know, I think you could look at that as a deliberate thing as well. It's a tool that colonizers use as a tool of colonialism, you know, not to... You know, as I say, the victors, you know, tell history. And so that's how sort of they have gone about telling the history in this country, deliberately leaving out not just the horrors of what happened on the frontier, but also the courageous brave, honourable sacrifices of Aboriginal men and women all over this country who laid the ultimate sacrifice for us to be here today and for us to still continue that struggle.
Absolutely. It's so important. Can you, in case we've got new listeners that don't really know, mm-hmm. are you able to just tell us what are the Frontier Wars exactly?
Definitely. The frontier, as it's sort of known, and it's sort of those early period of time, especially when the British or other sort of colonial powers back then were, and I'm not going to say finding, but invading many Indigenous nations. In America, it was called it sort of marks this period of time where explorers, are sent out to look for lands that are fertile, that are, in abundance of resources, and is livable. And then there's these phases in that frontier period, which are invasion, and then settlement, like that period of staying and setting up and establishing a colony.
Yes.
And then the stage of continuing like that period of war and invasion and assimilation, which is another form of that kind of later stages of, I guess, the frontier, but also that part of in the invasion sort of whether it's British, the Spanish, or whatever nation wants to sort of take over Indigenous lands. And here in particular, it was a very fast and brutal process, from about 1788 up until like the 1940s, well into the beginning of what now has become Australia, well after the foundation of this country. They were still planning and executing massacres of Aboriginal people, forcing mob off specific land and shipping them to missions and reserves, which we still call concentration camps in this country as blackfellas. And within that period of time, there was battles, wars that were fought all over this country. And when we think of wars, and I guess what we're taught to be wars, we look at, World War One, Two, Vietnam, Iraq, all these, wars that the West are involved in. And then we get told, oh, no, it wasn't a war, it was just like a skirmish here, there and everywhere. But in that time, now and for quite a period of time, there's always been evidence to say that, these were legitimate sort of wars in different parts of this country and were described as such by squatters and by military sort of personnel with those soldiers. There was governors who described, wanting to take Aboriginal people as prisoners of war. Those soldiers who were in combat against Aboriginal people, they were veterans of military campaigns in other parts of the world that Britain was involved in. So, it wasn't as if they were just sort of soldiers on some kind of peacekeeping mission to secure land for Britain. No, they were over here
with instructions to exterminate any kind of resistance from Aboriginal people at any time, at any place. And majority of the times when it was on the terms of Aboriginal people defeated, soldiers and had the upper hand. And then there's a whole discussion around, the discussion of warfare and how the Europeans would go to war and how blackfellas over here would go to war as well. The Western side of war is to just invade, kill everything, destroy the land, take prisoners or just kill. Where the concept of war over here, and maybe with most Indigenous folks around the world, it was in a controlled space. There were people who sort of overlooked how this war between nations would have went. It wasn't just sort of a sort of battle of, I'm going to kill and take everything and, usurp their power, their people, their land, their sovereignty. It was never a thing like that. It was always, to solve conflicts between, Indigenous peoples. And then usually after that, it would be a ceremony and it would be like a process of coming together.
I see, yep.
Yeah, like for us Kumori fellows, we went to war with Bundjalung. They were one of our nearest nations. We would always go to war with them fellows. But at the end of that war, what we did was our two nations came together and we have a dance, a war dance we do, where one half of the dance Kumori do and the other half of the dance the Bundjalung fellows do as well. So this was a similar way to squash, conflicts between nations and also marriage, the trading of symbols and all those other things as well.
Yeah. So you actually did a beautiful ritual people did a beautiful ritual back then to actually help with dissolving conflict. Whereas, you've got the colonists who formulated specific operational responses to Indigenous resistance.
Definitely,
and that means denial of their existence, terra nullis, didn't it?
Totally, and we're in a very unique position here, in what is so-called Australia, because we were sort of left, I guess you could say, to our own devices in regards to how we use and how we work with this land, but also how we work with each other as blackfellas. We're a continent that is solely, not connected to any other kind of landmass where, you have Russia, China, India, Africa, the Middle East, even the Americas kind of thing. They're all, one huge continent, a lot going on. But we've sort of had to, deal with each other for so long. We've had the time to sort of, work out governance structures here and, humanize how we interact with each other on levels that take into consideration battles and wars, even in those instances when we had those conflicts with each other, it wasn't to take over or to usurp or to enslave people.
And that's a really good point that you make, Bo, because that's actually not said too much in the mainstream media. It's always about the negatives, and it's really great that you've been able to talk about.
Well, and then that goes back to that part that we were talking about in regards to the narrative that they want to tell. The victors tell history, so they want to tell a history where we were just savages. We gave up the land. We didn't want it. And in today's society, we're just criminals. We're victims. We're poor people, we're a dying race and all this other all this other crap that they want to say as well. And that's played into the hands of the majority of white fellas in this country where, you know, whether they've met black fellas or not, that's a perceived notion that they have in their head about black fellas.
absolutely.
Sadly, you know, and that's the narrative and that's the story that they've told for so long. So that's why so many Australians, to this day, will continue to normalise racism towards black fellas in this country and justify so many different things, whether it's, you know, black fellas dying in custody, if they just done what the cop was told them to do, then they wouldn't have died, or, you know, what is she now? She's the opposition leader, Susan Lane. When she was the environmental minister years ago, she was involved in discussions in regards to mining companies in my country, Gumara country. I don't know if it was Shenmire or Whitehaven. She did a quote where she said that the economic benefit from this mining project outweighs the cultural significance of the Gumara people. So not just what and how people see us, but also how they see the land and how they value the land as well. So this is, you know, why they think so low of us in this country. It's because it's been this long narrative that's been told since these fellows have jumped the ship. You know, like...
Exactly.
Like all Indigenous and black folks around the world, you know, like with whether it's like Darwin's theory of human evolution, we were always seen as sort of the last, you know, the sort of smallest brains and like the lowest in sort of the evolutional scale as well. And, you know, like that still continues to stay that narrative. And that's why we had, you know, bloody Nazis all over this country and rednecks on the 31st, the last month, you know, carrying on to think they own this country.
Well, look at all the Nazis that have risen, and there was an attack on camp sovereignty as well.
That's it, you know, and this notion that, oh, you know, where is this country going? It's like, oh, hold on, wait a minute, this country has always been like this. You know, like, the difference with nowadays and back then is, like, we, you know, can film racism. It's just those who justify it, you know, now on social media, which is sad.
Can you tell us where we can find the podcast? And are there any new ones?
Yeah, you can find it on, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. They're the main sort of sources for the podcast.
Sure.
I don't have any episodes out yet, but I've just been working on some other projects. Up here, like me and a mate have put together like a calendar of conflict sites here in Southeast Queensland, which is pretty cool. So the goal with that, not all, but like some of those sites on that calendar, I've already done episodes for the podcast. So the goal is to do, you know, fill out that calendar with episodes, but also change that into a map as well.
Good.
And then also have conversations with the broader public as well and see how they feel about where they live, where they work, where their kids go to school. Like these places are named after, you know, people who have done horrific things to Aboriginal people. So hopefully they get upset and they want to, whether it's change your name, but also get involved in memorialising, remembering Aboriginal people. So just giving the chance for people to have a look at history and see if they want to sort of do something about what has happened and sort of how we can continue to move forward to change that narrative of racism and white supremacy in this country and challenge those things that these people have in their head about how they bloody look at black fellas, you know? So, and not just black fellas, but like, you know, queer people, trans people, disabled people, you know, like immigrants, especially at the moment with Palestinians, you know, like What has happened on the 31st is a result of sort of 2 years of solid campaigning from Palestinian, diaspora and their supporters, especially here in Australia. And then the power of Zionism and these Zionists, to sort of control a narrative to try and play into the minds of rednecks and play that whole, Islam versus Christianity, all that bullshit and just to find another way to justify war and taking somebody else's land.
Exactly, and I think really what you've been trying to say, what you have said throughout this whole yarn is that basically the frontier wars are not recognised as real wars and acts of resistance.
No, it's not, and like there are people in different places around the country, well-meaning white people, that want to make certain changes in regards to how we remember. I know there's a lot of stuff down in Canberra with the war memorial, but it'll be interesting just to see their views and values on Palestine and if they support, the Palestinian people and their struggle, because like one of the things in this country that the Palestinian struggle has done is really shone a light on, Zionists and shown them for who they are and how they exploit other movements and, like up here, like I don't vote and I never have. Maybe if there's like a deadly black fellow with amazing politics, maybe I will vote, but up here, the Labour Party full rolled the Greens in like the state election and council elections up here, and they've done a full number and took a lot of seats. And it was interesting, and I think it was a push from a lot of those Zios in those parties, and just and then made it a sort of a Labour Liberal thing, don't get me wrong, half of these Greens are clowns, anyways. They full done Lydia over, which a lot of us still remember as well. But up here, those, and then like everywhere else, Zionist influence has really stepped their game up in regards to the struggle against the struggle for to support Palestinian people. But, as always, that's what we're faced with, so we continue to struggle and fight and move forward as well.
It's really important. Sorry to interrupt. And I think that, before we finish, because we've got a couple of minutes left, we also have to, I suppose, and this is something that Lydia Thorpe about weeks ago now, and that we always speak about the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody and that the recommendations haven't been upheld.
No, they haven't been upheld, not just for, 30-plus years, maybe 100-and-something years.
Yeah,
in the 1850s down in Sydney, as part of the penal system, where they were, locking up convicts, they were locking Aboriginal people up as well. And there was a case, I don't know if it was 3 or 5 Aboriginal people died in the penal system, and there was an investigation why Aboriginal people, or like these 5 or 3 ticked it off. Obviously, there was way more prior to those couple of individual blackfellas that died, but the same sort of treatment that has always been happening to Aboriginal people. So they're coming in beaten up, shot, bashed, malnourished from the from resistance and from struggling against invasion, and their lands being destroyed by cattle and crops and stuff. And so they would come in contact with the prison system, you know, that have open wounds, that were getting infected, the food that they were eating, you know, they weren't used to. But also the isolation as well was a huge thing that played on the mental state of Aboriginal people. And so there were cases where like, you know, these doctors would examine some of these inmates, these black sort of inmates, that examine them, you know, their state while they're in prison and then also their state while they're out of prison, while they were sort of outside of prison, and they said their mental state was, like, totally different.
We're going to have to stop there because, sorry to interrupt you, it's been amazing, but this show is just about to end. So thank you so much for coming onto the program.
That's okay. Thanks, Dan.
And I'm hoping I can have you back really soon.
Definitely.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
All good. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So it's up to us, the people. We need a treaty in this country. We need the end to the war in this country. And the only way we can do that is through a peace treaty. Not the one you see in Victoria, not the one you see in Queensland, not the one you see in the Northern Territory, because they talk treaty and still lock our people up. They still kill our people. They still desecrate our land and our water. A treaty means peace. A treaty means equality. And a treaty means justice. Thank you.
You're listening to Radical Radio on 3CR. 855 on your AM dial, 3CR digital, and podcasting and streaming on 3cr.org.au.
Goodbye from Marissa, and thank you to all our guests for coming onto the show today. We're going to be going out now with our theme song, Blackfella, Whitefella, by the Rumpy Band, and stay tuned every Monday for the Doin' Time show, 4 to 5. Bye.
As long as you a true fella, as long as you a real fella. All the people of different races with different lives in different places, it doesn't matter what your name is, we got to have lots of changes. We need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters if we're to save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we shout it?
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.